from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. A little over 20 years ago, writer Anne Lamott became a mother, a story she chronicled in her book, Operating Instructions, A Journal of My Son's First Year. Not quite 20 years later, in the summer of 2009, she received a surprising phone call from her son Sam. He was about to become a father. Now Lamott is back with a new book about becoming a grandmother. It's called Some Assembly Required, A Journal of My Son's First Son. As the book reveals, the assembly that's required includes Lamott herself. We'll talk with Anne Lamott about the book, about family, and being a grandmother after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Anne Lamott's new book explores familiar Lamott terrain, family life, and the butt-kicking surprises it often delivers, like becoming a grandmother when your son is just 19. Lamott says she always wanted to become a grandmother. She just didn't expect to attain that status just now. But as she notes in the book, this is life on life's terms, not Annie's. So with her son's permission, she started writing about the twists and turns, the heart-pounding fears, and the almost unbearable sweetness of watching a child, your grandchild, grow. Jax, she writes, is as gorgeous as God or a crescent moon. Like so much of Lamott's writing, it's honest enough to make you squirm, funny enough that you want to read it out loud. It's the kind of book that somehow manages to make you want to roll your eyes and clutch at your heart on successive pages. Written with her son Sam, it's called Some Assembly Required, A Journal of My Son's First Son. And Anne Lamott joins us now. Good morning.
Hi, Dave.
Pleasure to have you here. Tell me about that first phone call that you got from Sam back in, I guess it would have been the spring of 2009.
It was November. It was like about, I think about 3 hours after conception. It was November of 2008. And it was the day before Thanksgiving, I'll never forget. And I had 20 people coming for dinner because these sorts of things never happen in a quiet glade of time. They happen with 20 people coming. And he said, Mom, I'm going to be a father. And I said, oh, Sam. And I was stunned. It was the last thing I'd been expecting when I woke up that morning. And I was scared. And I was a tiny bit angry. And boy, was it an experience of true powerlessness. And we made an agreement to talk later that day, luckily. And because the acronym I like the most in some assembly is WAIT. Why am I talking? And so I got off the phone, and of course I called my friends. I said, it's all over. It's hopeless. Sam's going to be a father. We're doomed. He'll drop out of college. He'll end up at the rescue mission. Da-da-da. I'm too young to be. And then I talked to him later. Okay, honey. Well, so.
And those combinations of feelings sort of are sustained throughout. You often write about, I'm sick with fear. I'm angry. I want to control this. And I'm totally happy.
Yes. That pretty much says it all sometimes at the same moment. But, you know, people that are spiritual or religious like to go, some of them, go around saying, you can't have faith and fear at the same time. And I think that's such a crock because you'd never want to sit down next to somebody who felt that, who just had everything all sorted out and lived in this spiritual certainty. Like, to me, that's just an act of aggression. And I have a lot of fear. I'm a pretty worried person. I was pretty much a lifelong scaredy cat. And I also have this huge faith. I knew things would sort out, and I knew it was going to be hard for everyone.
What were you most fearful of? Was it for Sam, or was it for your grandchild to be?
I think, to be honest, it was for Sam. And then me, and then Jax, in that order. I was never afraid for Amy because she's very, very strong, very capable and determined person. She so wanted to have this baby. I was worried for Sam because as a parent, your hope and is that your child will get a college degree or at least get some sort of career mentoring so that they're going to be off and running and be able to make their own living and find a niche for themselves in this kind of scary, inhospitable world. And so at 19, he was at the end of his first year of college. And to me, with my tiny, tiny control issues, it wasn't what's ideal. Let's say it wasn't ideal. I was afraid for me because I knew I was going to think it was my baby somehow too, and that I was going to have my endless good ideas and that everybody was going to be mad at me all the time as a result of my good ideas and my desire to help. I heard a great line the other day that help is the sunny side of control. And all I want to do is help. And that's another way of controlling. And I was a little afraid for Jax because it's not, again, ideal to have such young parents.
Anne Lamott joining us. Her new book is called Some Assembly Required, A Journal of My Son's First Son. Tell me about Sam's reaction to the idea of this book, which he writes about and is a partner in writing this book with you. What he said when you said, what would you think, Sam, if I wrote a book about this?
I didn't pitch it that way at all because you know as a parent that if you have a good idea, your parents, your children, just as a debt of honor to themselves, need to scoff at it and resist. But my editor had said, would you ever consider writing a sequel to Operating Instructions about Jax? And I said, well, I think that would be exploitive. And he said, well, it wouldn't be if you didn't exploit anyone, which literally had not occurred to me. And so I said, well, I'll ask Sam. And Sam, as you know from the preface, was over the moon about it because he loved Operating Instructions.
It's we should describe for listeners who aren't familiar with that book that you wrote 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was take one on this question.
It was the subtitle was A Journal of My Son's First Son. And I was a single mother. I was absolutely dirt broke. And the father had made it very, very clear he wanted absolutely nothing to do with this. He had a couple of grown kids. And I decided that because there were not books in existence that covered the mixed grill aspects of being a parent. And I'd always told my writing students, write what you'd like to come upon. And what I would have loved 22 years ago, almost 23 years ago, was for there to be a book to say, you are just going to be so crazy some days, yeah, and you're going to realize you don't like children. I had this one idea I wrote about in Operating Instructions that I had a colicky baby. So at like 2.5 months, I thought, I'll bundle him up really carefully and I'll just leave him outside for this one night so I can catch up. And the thing was, none of the baby books had mentioned that. And every mother I mentioned it to said, oh, me too. I get it. And mostly my theology and my work is sort of me too. It's like we're all in the same boat. And so with this book also, the grandparents that I mentioned, these terrible tendencies towards control, say, yeah, me too. And they say, what do we do? And I say, this works for me. Don't bother with that. This is no win. What if you waited? What if you didn't say anything? What if so?
You write about the difference between being a parent and being a grandparent, mm-hmm, often throughout the book. And I just want to read this one passage to get into this part of this story where you write, kids are hard. They drive you crazy and break your heart. Whereas grandchildren make you feel great about life and yourself and your ability to love someone unconditionally after all these years. A friend of mine said, when I return, I'm only having grandchildren, not children.
Pat Gomez, I love that line because it's really ideal. Because one thing is that they're not yours. They really are not yours. And
so you never want to wrap up Jax and leave him outside?
No, because, well, he spends the night several times a week. But Sam, he stays with Sam at the other end of the house. So that's wonderful. And the thing is, they leave, you know, and every grandparent I know is absolutely, utterly pooped all the time. But then the children leave. Then you pick up and you hit the restart button and you get out the latest New Yorker and you kick back and you go, God, because you're so tired. But you get your life back. With a parent, it's 24/7.
You mentioned earlier, and this is a theme throughout the book, this question of wanting to help, wanting to fix, to a degree, wanting to control. Mm. Not so much with Jax, but with your son, with Sam and with your grandchild's mother, Amy, and their tumultuous relationship, mm-hmm, which plays out throughout the book. Any progress on that front in terms of just sort of kind of learning that lesson?
Well, it's like everything. It's like, right, everything I know about anything applies to anything else I may set my mind to. Everything I know about writing, which is that you do it bird by bird, that you write terrible first drafts, and that you get to ask for a lot of help, applies to mothering and grandmothering. And so I started out really bad at this on July 20th, 2009, because you just want to get your mitts on the kid. And little by little, people are sharing stuff with you. They're against all odds helping you get your sense of humor back when the kids have been cross with you because of your good ideas that you know would help them. And people get your sense of humor back, and then you're off and running again. And little by little, I learned this great prayer, God, keep one arm around my shoulder and one hand over my mouth. And I learned not to share my good ideas.
Does that mean, though, that in the end, being a parent still trumps everything, that you still have this desire to want to be – to help Sam more than anything?
I think so. But you also – I mean, one of the – some of the grace of getting older is that you realize that most of the stuff you think you know is maybe tentative at best, and that – and that most of the time when you try to help or fix people, they end up mad at you. And you just start to give up on having a lot of influence after people are grown-ups on their decisions and their life choices. And you also start to realize, because of your own, I was 58 on Tuesday, you just realize people are really on their own hero's journey. And I didn't want my parents running alongside me with their clipboards and their Post-its, not that we had Post-its back then. But Sam doesn't want me running alongside him on his hero's journey. He's here to find out who he is, not who I wish he were or think he would be happier being.
How are you different with Jax, who now is pushing three?
Pushing three, yeah.
So how are you different with him as a toddler than you were with Sam at that age?
I would say in almost every way and barely at all, you know, because in one way, I'm different because he's not my kid. And one of the most helpful things, I think it's in some assembly, but if not, a woman who was a grandmother said to me the wisest words, that this is their baby. You know, keep your mitts off Jax. He's Amy and Sam's baby. And then one day I just said, well, at least I can go in and clean their kitchen up for them, because they lived in an apartment in San Francisco. And let's say the dishes had gotten ahead of the game, the curve. And the same woman said to me, remember how we talked about this being their baby? Yeah, yeah. Well, it's their sink, too. And so I have kept my mitts off him. I'm not fixated. Parents, you can't really help but be pretty obsessed with your kid. How are they doing? Who has hurt their feelings? How to get revenge for that? How to destroy the child and his or her family who have hurt or humiliated your child? How to make sure they have a leg up educationally? What you should or should not do for them, for their spiritual development? With a grandchild, it's just none of your business. And then at the same time, you just fall so in love. Well, you know that. You just fall in love. The second you see him, you're doomed. So mostly I'm a much, much better grandparent than I was a mother. Hmm. Yeah.
We live in a time, it seems, where grandparents are more engaged in the sort of daily stuff of life. I've had a number of young parents tell me how they couldn't quite make it if they didn't have that helping hand from a grandparent, whether that's financially or doing the dishes. So how do you weigh that? How have you begun to sort that out about the way in which you really do need to be helpful right now, it seems, in our current time, without sort of doing the dishes every night?
I really seek a lot of advice. I have a couple mentors in the book. One is Horrible Bonnie, who is a grandmother to many children and raising a couple of children of her daughters, who is on the streets a lot of the time. And I seek wise counsel. You know, I think that's what I know mostly as a writer, is you get to ask people, is this working? Does this work? Does this make sense? And the horrible thing is people will tell you the truth, which is why I call her Horrible Bonnie. Like with your writing, someone might say, I'm going to love this, but I got to tell you, the first few pages left me cold. Got to tell you, every time that character appears, I want to skip ahead. So I ask people to tell me the truth. Of course, then I become bitter when they tell the truth. People tell me, get off of Sam's back. Get off of Amy's back. Get out of their way. You know, get on with your own life. It's like, oh, yeah, right, my own life. Because with a kid, it's so hard to remember that their life is really theirs. You raise them to leave you. You raise them to individuate, and it's painful.
You say at one point, I think, that the quality you want as a parent is to be dispensable, not indispensable.
Did I say that?
I think so.
I didn't mean it.
I'm going to go.
Dave, I didn't mean it. Okay, I did.
It's on page 195. I have a note right
okay.
here.
Okay, so say I did. What was the question?
Well, you want to launch them and not be sort of grabbing onto their backs
and not
all the time.
Grasp and cling and try to sit on their shoulder. Remember the devil and the angel in the old cartoons? Well, you do it like you do your writing. You do it like you do your meditation. You do it one day at a time, and some days don't go as well as one had hoped. And I also practice, you know, the way to Carnegie Hall. In the same way that some days I'll say, I need to do a few days without sugar because I happen to have a gigantic sweet tooth. I need to go for a few days without sugar. And no matter what happens, I can get through one day at a time without sugar. I have skills and I'm not going to call Sam. I'm going to release him today. I'm going to get out of his way. I'm going to get off his back. I'm going to get on with my own life. And just for today. Just for today. And then the negative, like I have 37 bad voices in me that I've written about in terms of bird by bird and writing and whatnot. And those 37 voices say, what's that going to help one day or one horrible paragraph or how is that going to be useful at all? And then there's two voices that go, well, let's just do it. You know, you take the action and the insight follows. It's not the other way around. So just for today, I'm going to release Sam. I'm going to absolutely trust he's a good guy. He's a beautiful young man of almost 23, and he can be trusted. And today I'm going to act like I actually believe that, and I'm going to do other things.
And does that hold for today?
No, unfortunately, I had a little slip in the green room, and I texted him. I have this person he talks a lot about in some assembly called Worried Mommy.
Yeah.
And then there's also Guilt Mongering Mommy. But Worried Mommy just sent him just the tiniest text. I don't see how that could have done any harm at all.
One of the things that I'm interested in hearing from you also is what you've learned from Sam in all this. The book is titled With Anne Lamott, With Sam Lamott. And you use this interesting form through the book where you include emails from Sam and you include short interviews with him. And part of what's interesting to see is his own. I mean, it's a book as much as any about his own observations. And I just want to read one because I just thought it was such a keen observation, and I think this is an email he sent to you where he writes about how he and Amy are dancing, and he writes, when Jax watches me and Amy dance around the room, he registers how complexly we're moving. I think he understands that he's not like us yet, that he still needs to be cared for, that he can't just walk around. But also, he knows he's evolving every day, watching us dance. I think he's thinking, wow, that looks cool. I'd like to do that. Maybe we'll learn that next week.
I've forgotten that, to tell you the truth, and I really love that. He wrote a couple of set pieces that are maybe just two or three pieces, pages, the piece on Father's Day, and then the report on my brother Steve-O's wedding, yeah. Sam was the best man. And those two pieces just break my heart because you think that when you have kids, they're going to be kind of mini-me's. They're going to be reflective, and they're going to be like you, but with youth and vitality. And they're really their own individual person. They have a cell membrane around them that protects their integrity from people like us, the Huns, who would change someone for their own advancement. And Sam is really his own true self, like Jax is too. And some of the stuff that Sam said, I thought, God, who's writing your stuff for you? Because it's really profound. I also think it's really important for the voices of young men to be heard. I think they're going to be part of our salvation. And he was a 19-year-old boy with a baby and in school to be an artist when he grew up, you know. And 19, you don't even have a fully formed neocortex, but his voice is important. It's important to say to other young people, you know what? This is a trip. It's not a Hallmark movie. It's kind of like real life. It's really grueling and crazy making.
You say, I think at one point, being a parent is like having a terminal illness in a good way.
Yeah, exactly. It's real life. And people, I first really, I think, noticed this with Bird by Bird, which is also almost 20-year-old book. But people think that I have a fantasy life because this is my 13th book. You know, you would think I had really good self-esteem by now. But we're all in the same boat with everything, as activists, as parents, as grandparents, as people that are getting older, as people who are in this modern world where everything's going to hell in a handbag and yet is maybe the best of all possible times to be alive at the same time. And people think, well, I've done it so much. I sit down. I have ideas. I know what I'm doing. I write. Maybe it's not a good draft for me, but it's not really an awful first draft. You know what? I write really awful first drafts. That's the only way I've ever written anything that you or anyone else may really appreciate. I put the time in. It was boring. I'm never in the mood to write.
It's so interesting to hear you say that, because when you read a lot of your writing, it reads like it's just and talking, you know. So how do you get there? I mean, how do you get to that sense of it seeming like it's just fallen out of your mouth when, in fact, it's fallen out of your mouth and you've written it 7 different times?
Yeah, that's the fact. I've written it many, many different times. I've become a much tougher editor as I've grown up and as my ego has healed somewhat. And I love that line of Jessica Mitford's that you have to kill your little darlings and you have to go through the book and just take out the stuff that you think is so precious and profound and illuminating, because it's really probably just ego and trying to show off or get people to think you're more erudite than you are. And I also have a secret weapon, which is I have a couple people who read my stuff for me and they'll put brackets around stuff and say, you don't need this.
And how tricky was that with this book in particular? Because you're not only writing about your son and your grandson, but also your grandson's mother. How much did you have to say, is this okay with them? How much did you allow them to rewrite that eighth rewrite?
And not just my grandson's mother, but my grandson's mother's mother and grandson's mother's father and her whole tribe in Chicago and then in North Carolina. It was tricky. I won't hedge on that. It was tricky, and from the very beginning, Amy was into it, and she had loved operating instructions. And I said to her, I will work with you every step of the way. I have never aired my family's dirty laundry, and I'm not about to start now. Anything you read that you think I got wrong or that you don't want in the world, we'll talk about, and I'll. So if I'd written an absolute journal of my son's first year with all of Sam's stuff and all of my stuff, it would have been 550 pages, because I write 4 pages to find the paragraph and a half I was after the whole time. So does Sam. So does everyone. So a number of times, there's things Amy just doesn't think are funny that I think are hilarious, like the thing you probably remember where she has these two gorgeous, young, fabulous friends from Chicago. One is the godmother, and so I always pretend they're my like, bitter rivals and arch enemies. And so I'll go around when they were going to visit or stay. I'd say, oh, I'm going to take them out to Samuel P. Taylor Park, and then I might push one of them in the river. We'll see about the other one. And Amy won't think that's funny. I'll go, no, that's funny. It's not funny. But so I had to take all that stuff out except for one reference when I was going to sick the dogs on both of the girls one morning at breakfast.
We'll pick up on what's left in and what's left out of Anne Lamott's new book, written with Sam Lamott, called Some Assembly Required, A Journal of My Son's First Son. And we'll take your calls. If you'd like to pose a question to Anne Lamott, you can join us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, writer Anne Lamott. Her new book with Sam Lamott is called Some Assembly Required, A Journal of My Son's First Son. If you have a question or a comment about being a grandma or about that experience that you'd like to hear more from Anne Lamott, you can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. Let's hear first from Erica this morning in San Francisco. Erica, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much. I resonate with one of Anne's comments about being a grandmother and how enjoyable that is after having been a parent for so many years. I heard that comment, immediately thought of myself, and there's a loophole to the grandparent enjoying the grandchildren thing, and that is being an aunt or an uncle. And in my experience, I haven't had children yet, and perhaps maybe one day will, but in the meantime, enjoy my sister's child, and of course my good friend's children become, you know, the aunt, in fact, to them. But I give them back as soon as I'm done. Have a wonderful couple of hours or an evening with them, you know, going through all the mayhem that young children bring into your life, completely enjoying it and turning into a child myself, in fact, when I'm with them. But by the end of a few hours, I'm tired.
Yeah.
And they go home, and it's been a wonderful experience for all parties, in fact. But, you know, I acknowledge being a parent is really hard work, and after all those years, you can now have maybe greater satisfaction giving the grandchildren back. But, it's a wonderful experience.
Thanks, Erica. Thanks for the call. It is a great experience. And part of what is also fascinating about your book is it's really this family story. I mean, it's of course primarily about you and Jax and Sam and Amy, but you write a lot about family mm-hmm. within the book as well. And I actually wanted to read this one part because I just thought it was so insightful. And you write, this family business can be so stressful. Difficult, damaged people showing up to spend time with other difficult, damaged people. Time that might be better used elsewhere. Yet out of that, some accidental closeness, laughter, some pieced together joy.
Yeah, I live by that. And I have been defined by having cousins and aunts and uncles. And I'm not one of those people that thinks you have to have a child to experience the profound riches and catastrophe of loving people just beyond all words. And I know it's people that are aunts and uncles and gay aunts and uncles. And Sam has had gay aunts and uncles who have been the most important male mentors he's been with. And I think that whole myth of parenthood is just that. And that parents like to go around saying it, you really don't know what you're capable of, what you will say. And some of the most miserable, godforsaken people on earth are parents. And they go around saying that. And I think, thank you for sharing, because it's not about having had a child. It's about loving a child. It's about opening your heart. It's about becoming available to a child. If you're available to a child, that's all that really matters.
Bill in Martinez joins us next. Bill, go ahead.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air, Bill. Go ahead.
Hey, I wanted to talk about Anne's book, Traveling Mercies, but I wanted to say, being a parent, probably my only regret is we only were able to have one child, and it's just a wonderful experience. But I wanted to say that I became aware of you, Anne, when my mother passed away. Someone gave me the book, Traveling Mercies, and I share a very similar religious orientation to you, and just having the sense of, instead of running the good race, kind of stumbling towards the kingdom. It was a really touching book for me at that time. And also, the one thing that really touched me is, I guess you sat with, it's a little foggy now, but you sat with one of your friends as one of her parents passed away, and that was just, it just felt like a reflection of what had happened to me. I'll take my any comments just off the air.
Bill, thanks.
Thank you. I'm glad, because all I write about is how we're mostly in the mystery of it all, and that my great Jesuit friend Tom Weston says the opposite of faith is not doubt, it's certainty. And being positive that you have nailed it is probably the kiss of death. And for me, it's so humiliating to be a Christian, because most Christians seem to spend their time leafing through the Old Testament, finding new people to hate. But a lot of us are just kind of lurching and flailing and moving herky-jerky towards a slightly, slightly calmer sense that there is an animating intelligence in the universe and inside of our hearts, and that we can turn to that when we've run out of good ideas.
I pulled out a copy of Traveling Mercies actually last night, the book Bill references, and there's a chapter in it that I'd forgotten called Why I Take Sam to Church. Mm-hmm. And in this book, in Some Assembly Required, you write about at one point your desire to have Jax be baptized in the same church that Sam was.
And I.
And you as well, right. How does that church provide part of what you were just also saying about family in terms of damaged people being with other damaged people, and that out of that comes some speck of joy?
Something that we might dare to call grace, which for me is usually a little spiritual WD-40 when you're at your most clutched and clenched. But, you know, I found this little church, St. Andrew Presbyterian in Marin City, services at 11. I hope to see most of your listeners there Sunday. I found it drunk because I used to go to the Marin City flea market when I was hungover because I lived on a houseboat across the highway. And I just would hear this music coming from this cruddy looking sort of Waiting for Godot-like church and next to the flea market. But I'd also hear a lot of the songs that my parents raised me on, the soundtrack of the civil rights era, Joan Baez and the Weavers and Pete Seeger. And I just started to go over there because I was done. I was 32. And as somebody once said, I was deteriorating faster than I could lower my standards. And I went over there, and I went there for a year off and on. And the thing was, the people didn't hassle me. I was clearly a person in a lot of pain. I had three books out. I mean, I was, and I lived in the same county with all these aunts and uncles. I was loved beyond all sense of, comprehension. And yet, I couldn't stop drinking. I don't have an off switch. And I'd go to this church, and they wouldn't bug me. You know, they wouldn't try to sign me up for a class. They wouldn't try to help me figure out who shot the Holy Ghost. And most important for all ministers or lay people in churches, they didn't insist on coming to do a home visit, because if they had said they wanted to come visit me, I would have run screaming for my cute little life.
You said they didn't rush you like it was a sorority.
They didn't rush.
Rush
me. They let me sit there and be wounded, and the air there was nutritious and is nutritious, and so I just kept coming back. And that's what Woody Allen said before I turned on him, that's 80% of life.
Carol in San Francisco is up next. Carol, go ahead.
Good morning. It's an honor to speak with you. I have one comment and a question, which is, what happens when the tiger mother becomes the tiger grandmother? There's such a strong Asian tradition of the village raises the child, the grandparents have a big say in nurturing and developing the child. Are you presenting the Western perspective that grandparents should not be involved? And hasn't that kind of evolved as our country has evolved? And the one question is, talk to me about Occupy and what you're doing, what you're thinking politically about that. I know it's a completely different topic, but I'd love to hear your comments.
Well,
thank you very much.
On Asian grandparenthood, I can say honestly, this is a topic on which I know zero. And I don't have a position on what anyone else should do. My position is, do you have a minute? Let me tell you a story I think is sort of funny. And I practice a Me Too theology and a Me Too relationship with my readers. I don't say stuff I don't know anything about. And by the same token, I don't tell stuff that I don't want you to know. So I share my experience, strength, and hope insofar as I don't think it will be harmful to Sam or Amy or Jax, my brothers, my cousins, or anyone. I know nothing about what other people should do as grandparents. And about Occupy, I'm just completely, completely behind them, and I love them, and I haven't gotten involved except to support and lift them up as often as possible in my own work. I'm a thwarted activist right now because I really haven't had anything resembling a regular life for about 3 months now. I sort of miss it.
Some emails people would like your comments on. Elizabeth writes in, first, I wish I could write like you. I've read all your books. I've tried to emulate you, but it's not going to happen. Second, I have two girls, a 9-year-old and a 7.5-year-old, and have begun the letting go process as my kids grow. How do you balance nurturing your child, including doing all of their chores for them, protecting them from everything, and letting them go and to make their own mistakes?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, Peggy Orenstein is the person who's so brilliant on being a mother in the modern world with a daughter and and finding a way to nurture and hold space for her to Daisy to grow into her own daisiness without and protecting her from the cultural the devastation of being a girl and a woman in this country where it's an institutionalized contempt for the gender. So Peggy Ornstein's the one to read. And to the bigger question, though, of how do you know sort of where one thing stops and the next thing ends is just like you do with writing, how you figure out what you're working on. It doesn't matter that you don't write like me. I barely write like me. I write like me 5 and 6 drafts later. So what does matter is that you just do it and you do it badly and you make mistakes and you seek wise counsel and you have one or two people in the world, other parents with little girls or other parents with troubled teenagers who you can tell anything to who will say, you know what, me too, or I heard about this guy, I know about this woman who's doing that sort of work. You don't have to know more than you do, and figure it out is not a good slogan.
You write to that point to a degree too about part of this is learning that being right isn't always key. And this is what you say about this. You talk about how you're concerned that Amy might move away, the mother of your grandson might move away, and you bump into this lawyer who says, yes, you're right to be worried about this. And you write, the lawyer said I was right to be bothered by Amy's seemingly arbitrary decision to stay away longer. I felt better when we said goodbye. It was great to be right. Really, it's the most important thing, to be right and to know whom to blame. that's it too, isn't it? I mean, that process of realizing it really doesn't matter if you're
well,
right.
Well, as we were saying before the show, the problem is there's just no victory in it. And if there were a victory in being right and being positive that you know who to blame and you could get some progress from that, I would really urge all of us to continue it, but there's just no victory. You can be right or you can be kind. It's black and white. It's that simple. And I like to be right, and I believe I am right. And if I weren't right, I would have other ideas, which would then be the right ideas. But it just starts to argue a wasted life.
What I discover sometimes is I'm sort of on something and wanting to explain exactly why I'm right, and here are all the reasons why I'm right. And by the way, there's 7 more reasons why I'm right. And the person I'm talking with will say, yeah, you're right. And then I'll say, but I'm not done being right. I've got 14 more reasons.
Well, my wonderful friend Lori talks about feeling like this tired old lawyer with a battered briefcase showing up once again with her papers and her briefs and her arguments and her summary and dragging them back out. And it just starts to be, boy, none of us knows how long we're going to live.
Tori writes in, sometimes we learn what not to do from our parents. Do you notice Sam parenting in a way that is in opposition to your style? And if so, how do you feel about that?
Well, Sam and I have been on a book tour on the East Coast for 8 days together, the miracle of which we were still speaking afterwards. And we've been doing interviews and onstage events and stuff. And we've talked a lot about that. And in fact, in some assembly, I asked him, what is the stuff you loved most about me being a parent that you think you will continue doing with Jackson? He said, that's just so easy. You got on the floor with me all the time. You were good with Legos and drawing. And you, I practiced this kind of radical playfulness. And then I said, what was the thing you hate that you think you would never, ever do with your child? He said, that's really easy, too. The worry, you know, this endless worriedness. I had a mentor named Marshall who came from a very Jewish family in New York. And he said they had this Native American mantra they said every morning at the table that went, worry, 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 worry. And that comes with the territory of being a parent. You know, as soon as you see the sonogram of your kid, you stop drawing very complacent breaths. And so there's a very funny piece in there about how he's never going to be like me. He's not going to be worried. But then he becomes obsessed with the Mr. Bear blanket because
right.
It has a tiny tennis ball shaped bear head in one corner of a baby bear. And he's convinced it can trap carbon monoxide and Jax will suffocate. So,
And do you worry less about Jax in that same fundamental way? There's a chapter I remember from Traveling Mercies where Sam, then as a boy of 7 or 8 or something, I don't know, wants to go paragliding.
Mm-hmm.
And you debate this and you go back and forth and back and forth and finally decide, no, You can't do that. Now, if you were with Jax and he wanted to go paragliding, would you be easier with
him? Well, no one cares what I think. That's the thing about being a grandparent. It would be, once again, like even having a baby, who asked me. But it's funny because somebody came up to Sam at the Herps and said, did you ever get to go paragliding? And my heart got stuck in my throat. And I thought, oh, no, they're going to offer Sam a chance to go paragliding. But the thing is that I'm so much older. And you find out as you grow older that almost everything kind of sorts itself out, and people and kids mostly live. And so I think in a general way, I'm still worried that Sam will go paragliding. And in a meta way, I have come to see that most things sort of semi work themselves out.
Back to our calls. Ed is next in Oakland. Ed, go ahead, please, with Anne Lamott.
Yeah, I've got a question for Anne about a documentary movie I saw some years ago now. In which you were on screen a fair amount of the time with Sam, and I was surprised that, I want to put this in the most delicate way I can, I don't know if I'm going to succeed, I struck me as a real compromise of the privacy of somebody who had no way, he was 4 or 5 or at the most 6 if I remember correctly, who had no way, regardless of how well it was explained to him, what the potential ramifications of becoming a public person might be. And I was wondering how you came to make that decision that you wanted him to be on screen in the film.
Oh, well, I don't know. Let's see. I love the filmmaker Frieda Lee Mock, who was an Oscar Award winner. She's a brilliant woman with enormous integrity. And the fact is, I was a very, very poor writer with a little boy, first an infant and then a little boy, and I was trying to make a living. I think it really came down to that, is that I raised Sam as a writing, working mother, and he grew up on the books, on floors of bookstores and libraries and at pulpits and in the wings. And he grew up with a lot of people knowing who he was. And all I could do was make absolutely sure that nothing I ever wrote or said about him would be anything that he regretted. And, you know, he grew up with thousands of people pulling for him and praying for him. So that was the other side of his of whatever privacy was invaded.
Well, and he also says in the preface of this book that Operating Instructions, which was the genesis, I think, of the documentary that's being referenced here, that he still considers that his greatest gift, which must have been remarkable for you to hear.
It was. It really brought tears to my eyes. And, you know, ever since he was about 10 or so, I've run every single thing past him and given him a chance to, and he has taken it, believe me, to edit and change anything I've written that has to do with him, and for me not to run it if it ever came to that. His complaint was often that I made him look crazy and I seemed fine. And so a lot of the pieces were rewritten so that you could see that it was a very crazy, stressed out parent with a kid. And sometimes kids are annoying and scary. So I think it's a good question. I think I could answer it if I had about an hour.
You, on this question of Operating Instructions, the title of that first book of yours about raising Sam, you reference that within this book too, and about that there really aren't, in the end, operating instructions. There aren't. We all want them, but that there really isn't a map. But it is the instruction comes in that search, and that's where you find compassion. But but it's not laid out for you.
I think that's right. There's one piece in some assembly about how I wanted to write a letter to Jax and tell him the truth of all things, mostly, which is that when things aren't working electrically, if you pull out the plug for like 4 or 5 seconds, that it will reboot and everything will be fine. But the other thing was that everybody feels so much like a stranger in the strange land, and that everybody feels like there was a day in second grade, the day that they had strep throat and had to stay home, when the owner's manual was explained and where the wise elder came and said, here is the truth. Here is how to have good help, self-esteem. Here's how to break through your terminal uniqueness. How to break through the isolation and the feeling of being defective. And you don't have to have that anymore. And everybody feels like everyone else figured out. And the thing is, no one figured it out. We all have that terrible existential isolation. And but the fact is, we also did get owner's manuals from our parents. And for a woman, a girl, my friend Pat said, if you're an American girl over the age of 12, 12 and you're not mad, you've just completely missed the boat, you know. But we got owner's manuals from our parents, and they were a lie. They said, if we did this, this would work out. If we found this, achieved this, mastered that, bought this, found this, married this, we would be fulfilled. And it was always, as it turned out, an inside job. So over the years, you find sort of substitute pages for your owner's manual that you think do ring true and that you as a growing person get to decide to live by.
Here's part of that letter you wrote to Jax. No one got the instructions. That's the secret of life. Everyone is flailing around, winging it most of the time, trying to find the way out or through or up without a map. This lack of instruction manual is how most people develop compassion and how they figure out to show up, care, help, and serve as the only way of filling up and being free. And then you go on to say, and remember to unplug things. That's the key.
The main thing.
Let's hear next from Joyce. Joyce, go ahead.
Hi. I just want to say it's such an honor to speak with you and to try to seek some advice from you. I'm a huge fan. I'm 25. I was raised by a single mom, and I've got a brother with special needs who's now 18. I've basically helped raise him with my mom, and growing up, I've experienced firsthand the rewards and major challenges of what I suspect is parenting, and because I'm still, in a way, I'm raising him with my mom, I've just kind of, I don't know if I'm selling myself short here, but I just have no desire or intention to really have kids because I've just kind of really witnessed this and experienced this firsthand, like how difficult it is. And I'm just kind of wondering if I'm selling myself short, like if it really is different having raising my brother from having my own kid.
What a question,
Joyce. Another hour-long question if Dave and I had an hour, because it brings up absolutely everything. But again, it brings up the great palace lie that everyone's got to have a kid to experience firsthand the completion of their own selves. And it's such a lie. You know, more will be revealed for you, and you will know every you can be trusted. Like, great Mel Brooks line with writing where he said, listen to your broccoli and your broccoli will tell you how to eat it. And you will be able to know what is right for you. And what you think now at 25 is not necessarily what you'll think at 31 or 37 or 44, you know. And one thing some of our parents accidentally forgot to mention was that you get to change your mind and you can feel passionately one way about something, and it can turn out that the plates of the earth shift underneath you, or the, you know, life just sort of has a way of being like a meat tenderizer on your heart, and we soften and we kind of grow more rigid paradoxically at the same time, more set in our ways. And I just want you to know that you can be trusted. More will be revealed. You will know what to do for yourself, and that's all you need to know.
And I would also add, don't sell yourself short in terms of the great gift that you're giving your brother. So, Joyce, thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Let's get in one more call. Lee in Albany. Lee, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Anne, for distracting me from my taxes.
You're welcome.
You know, everybody should have a crash course in equivalent to Joyce's experience, because I agree with you so wholeheartedly that parenthood is a choice. And it's not a choice that everybody should make. But I really called to talk to you about your writing. Early in your writing career, I really recoiled from your writing. Our sons are about the same age, and I also raised him in a shared custody situation. And I always thought, oh, my God, she's not the only person who's ever had a child, is she? And because I thought you clung to those little darlings a bit much, even when you were being self-effacing, so-called. But I don't hear that in today's Anne, whom I really love. And I just think, what happened? What was the turning point? Or was that a gradual maturation of your voice?
Or it may have had absolutely nothing to do with me and have had to do with the changes that you have been through, because I can't really answer that for you. I still think a lot of those feelings of being the only mother and the only grandmother and the only everything. So it's hard to say where the changes in you and the changes of me start up and end. And so it may just be that we're sort of right for each other now, but that nothing huge has changed in either one of us.
I want to ask you last, in the few moments we have left, about something you write about towards the end that in a way is about, you know, the changes we all experience. And you're writing about, again, this question of sort of wanting to help. And you say, I somehow managed to hold my tongue in this one instance while considering various appropriate forms of correction. And then you say, after Sam and Amy and Jax left, I finally realized that I don't have the correction in me. Life is the correction. Life will correct Sam. And unfortunately, it will correct me too. Life sometimes corrects harshly. And even if they're both to free fall, I was not their parachute. Which seems to me exactly true and exactly impossible.
Yeah. It's so hard. I didn't mean to be defensive with the last person, although I think I always get a little tense when people use the word recoil about my work. But I know that she and I could sit down and talk forever, and what we would have is mostly stuff in common. But anyway, I appreciated her question. And the fact is that it's life that grows your children up. It's pain and loss and grief and dancing and communion and other people's kids and your kids and messes and failure and mistake and entire catastrophic administrations, although I won't name names, that shape us, that grow us, that rub some of the dirt off of us, that the crucibles we end up in. And, you know, I'm not what created or I am not anything. I was Sam's mother. I was just some 35-year-old woman who had a kid, and I've done the best I could, and I've made mistakes, and I make amends, and we're very close, and he has a lot of stuff that's going to happen this side of the grave, and I do too.
Last question. How's Jax?
Jax has a cold, so of course it's a nightmare. But as that last woman was mentioning, he's darling. He's absolutely everything you'd love in an almost 3-year-old. And he's funny, and he's just a lot like his dad. And he's playful, and he's silly, and he says no now. And he said, no noodles, no Nana, no apples, Nana.
Anne Lamott, the new book, Some Assembly Required, written with Sam Lamott, a journal of my son's first son. Pleasure to have you here this morning.
Thank you, Dave.
Forum is produced by Katrina Schwartz and Judy Campbell. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. Danny Bringer, our engineer. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.